Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at School Sucks Show. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
Free work is information. It's a way of marketing yourself. So if you're out there on the market and you're saying, I'm going to try to get you to pay attention to me, well, I could do it with a resume. That's a very bad form of marketing that no one's going to pay attention to. Or I could do it with a project. That's a really good form of marketing that is going to give me results, right? So if it's exploitation to do free work, then companies are being exploited constantly. Every time they create an advertisement for you on TV and don't make you pay for it and try to entertain you, every time they give you a free sample, they're being exploited, right? If companies took the same approach that these kind of like anti-exploitation advocates take, it'd be like, you can't look at the product until you pay me the money. Right. You'd be like really suspicious of that, right? So it's just a form of marketing. And then, I mean, how ironic is it, Brett, that people, it's almost always the same people who will say, telling people to go intern for free or whatever, you're being exploited. They all see education as an investment. They see spending 5 years paying somebody tens of thousands of dollars for the privilege of not earning a dime and not gaining any relevant skills, that's a good thing.
Right.
But I think it's worth really hammering home and saying, look, this is about you gaining the best opportunity you can. And even if you don't get the job that you put together a project or pitch for, what you'll learn by putting it together and the likelihood that that will help you get another job is tremendous. One good project is going to be worth more than sending out 50 generic resumes.
Everybody, this is Brett. Today is April 30th. I'm very pleased to be welcoming Isaac Morehouse to the program. Isaac is the founder of Praxis. Have you ever heard of it? Of course you have. I've mentioned it 1,000 times. And he is also now the CEO of a career launch platform that we're going to be discussing today called Crash. You can learn more about that at crash.co. It's a hub where people are able to make use of a lot of the tools and strategies we're going to be talking about on the show today. So we started talking about Praxis, I think, back in 2016. Their widely successful boot camp and apprenticeship program helping young people find a path around, perhaps over college. But over the last several years, Isaac and his team have recognized that there are a lot of people out there who are also looking to kind of relaunch their careers. Isaac also has a new book out. It's called Crash Your Career, Ditch the Gatekeepers, and Be Your Own Credential, a concept we've talked about many times on the show over the last few years. In the book, Isaac writes, degrees are dead, whether or not most people know it yet. The internet killed them. But it doesn't kill them by putting lectures and courses online. Remember, people don't pay tuition for the lectures and courses. The internet killed degrees because it brought the cost of information so low that now anyone anywhere can build a better signal than a degree through a digital footprint, brand, or body of work. You can now be your own credential. You can make something better than a third-party paper. We are going to talk about that process on the show today, soup to nuts and back to soup. How to decide what skills are worth pursuing, how to build those skills, how to signal those skills, and how to sell those skills effectively at the appropriate time, in the appropriate situation. So my last guest was Aaron Clary, and I appreciate the mostly positive but mixed feedback about that show. As much as I enjoyed the conversation with Aaron, I do promise today's show is more optimistic. But one of the things that came up in that conversation, and then again today, this fulfillment of purpose entitlement that a lot of young people have. And when I say a lot of young people, I mean like me, 20 years ago. Have I ever told you that in the year 2000, I graduated from a little college in Vermont with a bachelor's of science degree in communications? I took that piece of paper right into the video store that I worked at part-time to supplement my income at the school, and I said, things are about to change around here. Maybe a more accurate recollection of what happened would go something like, I had these needs that kind of collected into, I guess, a purpose at the time, that I was going to be an informer and an entertainer. I was going to work in the media. I was going to have cameras and microphones in front of me. I was going to present to captivated audiences. And I went out and I scoured the capital region of New York, which was a short hop away from where I was living in Vermont, looking for somebody to give me this opportunity. And the reality of doing this for, it seemed like maybe about a year, refined those expectations to the point where one organization, this crummy little boarding school that eventually wound up getting shut down in southern Vermont, said, hey, you want to put yourself before people and talk? Cool. You can stand at the front of this room in front of these 12 kids who wouldn't look up and express any interest if you burst into flames. Start there and see how it goes. And I did, but it was a slow process of accumulating pretty minor successes. And as I kind of look back at them, it's debatable whether or not they were successes at all when I think about the larger system that I was serving. But it definitely helped me build some confidence and develop a willingness to try new things. And I think that was an important experience to have. I grew up with a lot of advantages. I hadn't really endured a lot of hardships in my life by the time I went off to college. So looking back, I'd say I'm grateful for all those feelings of hopelessness at that job, all the desk chairs that came flying through the air at me. And after, a lot of frustration and perseverance through there, I started to shape more of a purpose. What do you like? What do you not like? What are you good at? What do you suck at? And that got me to a place where I could be happy every day, happy enough here to say, how could I be happier? How could I make this better? And the process repeats. And Isaac and I will discuss that on the show today. But that's been going on since I put in my 2 weeks notice at Video Update in Bennington, Vermont. One of the catalysts for me quitting that job, I had a falling out with the manager, the woman who was the manager at the video store. I was passed over for the role of assistant manager. The job was given to this woman who didn't know who Robert De Niro was. I'll never forget where I was the day, because I was in the video store, but I'll never forget where I was when a customer walked up to the counter and he says to her, do you have a section of Robert De Niro movies? And she said, who? I almost fainted. So here I am passed over for the assistant manager job. Not only am I very smart, I know who Robert De Niro is. And not only do I know who he is, but if this guy had said, what were Robert De Niro's 5 latest movies? I would have been like Jackie Brown, Wag the Dog, Marvin's Room, Sleepers, and Ronin, and make sure you come back next year when he takes a turn into comedy with Analyze This and Meet the Parents. That's where my Robert De Niro knowledge was at. And not only that, you can buy all of those films on clearance because the times are changing and we need to clean out all of our VHSs to make room for laser discs. I mean, this is de facto video store management if we've ever seen it, folks. I was in college studying communications. I saw the writing on the wall for VHS. Even though in college we were using Betamax, I'm not even making that up. But looking back and telling you this story right now, looking back at me in that time, it's no wonder why I was passed over for such a role. That was where my search for purpose began. But I walked out of that college thinking that I was entitled to discover it and start enjoying it right then. And that was not the case. Still working towards it now. A lot closer, hell of a lot closer than I was then. But certainly had to endure some challenge and frustration to even start getting a glimpse of what that purpose should be. Some big announcements coming soon. Ooh, I wish I could tell you now, but I can't quite yet. I talked to Jason Seib the day after I released our podcast. He was very, very pleased with the response. He said like 30 people bought his book right after that show came out. That's a big deal to me because, as you know, he's somebody that I have a lot of respect for. He was very influential, improved the quality of my life over the last year and a half. And as a result of this great connection, he and I are about to partner on something very exciting. Also, work continues on the virtual summit. I have a very impressive list of presenters that I will be announcing very, very soon. At this point, I think the first virtual summit is going to coincide with the 10th anniversary of School Sucks podcast later this summer. It's been put off a couple of times as I'm learning the process of doing this, plus looking at my travel schedule over the months of June and July. But everything is moving forward and I'm super excited. Another snag right now. Kind of want to crowdsource some advice on this, actually. I hate to do anything that sounds like complaining, but for the last 2 months, I have been unable to sit down at a desk for for any length of time. Back in February, I was at the gym and I was doing some leg exercise and something happened to my back. Now, there were some hints that things were not 100%, but it would get a little tweaked, it would be a little sore, and then it would heal up and I would be fine. Now, I am not fine. There has been no reduction in pain since February. Now, the back is a bit of a mystery. This has involved all kinds of explorations. It started with a chiropractor, but it has moved well beyond that. I'm actually going to get some spinal x-rays looked at as soon as I'm done posting this show today. But if you have ever struggled and found a solution for, I'm not looking to form a support group here, sciatic nerve pain. So when you have a shooting pain that originates in your lower back and then goes down one of your legs, that's the issue. It's definitely something that I need to get resolved before I can spend any lengthy period of time on a plane or in a car. Also, even with this injury, and I got cleared for this, I could still play some light tennis, some light racquetball. I could do many of the exercises that I like to do at the gym until about 10 days ago, I was doing pull-ups and something popped in my inner right elbow. After this happened, I could not even lift a barbell. And perhaps you're saying, Brett, maybe you need to be taking better care of yourself. I heard your confessions during the Jason Saib show. Maybe you should stop eating those gummy worms. Number one, they were gummy bears. What kind of man sits around eating gummy worms? And number two, as soon as that show was over, I made sure my cabinets were clear of all of that garbage, those little delights that I had succumbed to on those high-carb, low-fat days. There's no more of that. So that show was properly motivating to make the changes I need to make. But I have deduced that this injury is something called golfer's elbow. That is when it's on the inside of your elbow versus the outside. That's tennis elbow. But this is my dominant arm, and now all recreational activities are eliminated, and it's kind of a bummer. So if you have struggled with golfer's elbow and found a solution, even though I find golfer's elbow to be kind of a dainty description of this injury, I did it doing pull-ups after all. But if you pat it and you fixed it, don't hesitate to contact me. Obviously, I want to get back in action. Physical activity and exercise, very important pillar in my life. And very soon, I need to sit for long periods of time to drive to Connecticut for G. Edward Griffin's Red Pill Conference. That is coming up at the beginning of June. You're going to be hearing some of my interviews with presenters at the Red Pill Conference starting next week. I'll actually do some interviews while I'm there as well. And then I got to turn around and go all the way to Michigan. And I cannot wait for the 2019 Midwest Peace and Liberty Conference. Oh, I am really looking forward to this. We are going to be doing a live in front of a studio audience, interactive School Sucks podcast. So I cannot wait for the end of June. But that's it. Let's get into today's show. Always a pleasure to talk to Isaac. Had an awesome visit with him when I was down in Charleston a few months ago. Another former School Sucks guest, Jeff Till, was there. We had a beautiful lunch. And on a final note, if anyone told me a decade ago that one day I would be watching Fox News and cheering, I wouldn't have believed them. But Isaac drops in on the Tucker Carlson show once in a while and lays down some really beautiful truths. So I thought we would warm up with that and then we'll move into our conversation. Thank you so much for listening, everybody, and take care.
Last night on the show, we discussed the threat that artificial intelligence poses to American jobs. It's profound. Our leaders are ignoring that threat. They want to import more and more low-skilled labor. So Washington's not going to help you. That's for sure. They're making it worse. You're on your own on this one. So what can individuals do to survive an economy that is devaluing labor and, in a lot of cases, making it obsolete? Isaac Morris has thought a lot about this. He's the founder and CEO of Praxis, and he joins us tonight, one of our favorite guests.
Ours
Isaac,
too.
Thanks a lot for coming on.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So you've seen, obviously, these forecasts. They've come from a lot of different places. 60 Minutes this coming weekend is going to have a pretty scary one. But that some huge percentage of American jobs are going away. Let's say you're 22 entering the job market. What's your defense against this?
Yeah, so the first thing is what you kind of led with is to bring it back to what you have control over. So rather than letting yourself kind of getting consumed by fear of what will or won't happen in the macro economy, say, okay, what can I do personally? What do I have control over? And the first thing is robots, machines, what are they really good at? Following rules. So anything that involves a lot of rule following, I wouldn't be investing resources, energy, time in learning and building those kind of skills. I would be focusing more on rule breaking, on innovation, on entrepreneurship. And that is one of the challenges most of us, the sort of school system, the kind of the innovation, the entrepreneurship, it almost gets schooled out of us because it's all about rule following and, you know, learning to do exactly what's on the test. And entrepreneurship in the school context is called cheating, you know, creative problem solving. So I think breaking out of that mindset and not looking at it like, okay, I need to go and study and get certified and do what I'm told, and then I will be able to have a career. But rather, hey, if I want to do something, if I want to be the next Tucker Carlson, go start a podcast, go start a YouTube channel, get your hands dirty, try and fail, experiment and tinker. I think that's the biggest thing.
Well, it's such a wise point. Clearly, there's a, I mean, I'm all for following rules, but there's also a downside, and our schools seem to be getting more rigid, less open to creativity, less open to unorthodox thinking. So, I mean, that's a bad trend then.
It is. And it's the nature and the structure of, you know, a math system that's trying to push everybody through and same age group cohorts. And, you know, you have to think beyond that kind of traditional rule following idea. And you've got to just look at the opportunity that's out there. At Praxis, we work with young people all the time and we focus on trying to help them develop skills that are ultimately transferable and in demand no matter what. Because the jobs that are around today, nobody knew these were going to be here 20 years ago. And the same thing is true of the future. We don't know exactly what opportunities are there. So having skills that are very transferable and adaptable, you know, being creative and imaginative, communication skills, you know, the ability to work in teams, to cast a vision and to recruit people behind that vision. These sound like kind of fluffy soft skills, but honestly, those are the things that are the most uniquely human and the things that are hardest for machines to replace. And I think where you get the most return on your investment.
Isaac Morehouse, welcome to School Sucks Podcast.
Brett, thank you so much for having me. I was telling you before we got on here, I think I started listening to your podcast like way back in the day, probably around 2011, something like that. And, you know, I grew up homeschooled and I was already like, you know, kind of homeschooling our kids, but I had not really dived in much beyond my own personal experience. I enjoyed being homeschooled. And you were very instrumental in introducing me to a lot of the ideas, a lot of the thinkers, a lot of the concepts. So I'm a big fan. Excited to be here.
Awesome. Thank you for saying that. It's definitely mutual. Yeah, I've been looking at what's in my podcast feed. I'm just thinking about new people encountering it like over the last month and going, wow, this guy really has a thing about college. He really hates college. But from every conceivable angle, you know, celebrities paying off and bribing community college. We've talked about, you know, the opportunity cost of college all within the last couple of months. I hope people understand that I do like opportunity and I do like innovation. And even if the last couple months have looked kind of negative, I think we have a really positive and constructive conversation to have here today. You and I have talked before in this podcast feed, but not since 2015, I think. And in the meantime, I've talked to so many principals from Praxis, Zach, TK, Derek. I've talked to Praxis participants like Nick Runlett. My audience certainly recognizes your name as the founder of Praxis. And today we're going to talk about a new project called Crash, which is a career launch platform that moves around the apprenticeship aspect of Praxis. So there's lots of people who are interested in the Praxis model, but they might not be in a point in their lives, if I'm understanding it correctly, where they'd want to start with an apprenticeship.
Absolutely. Yeah. You can almost think of it like I've been using this analogy, and this is not an endorsement of any particular military actions.
Sure,
it's
sure.
It's just an analogy. If Praxis is like the special forces, you know, not everybody is ready, able, willing for various reasons to go join the Navy SEALs. It's a very intensive thing. It's really awesome. The outcomes are absolutely awesome. If you get in, you should do it, but it's not for everybody. But if you could say, hey, here's this one method of training that the Navy SEALs use, or hey, here's a weekend at a gun range where we'll come and train you how to shoot similar to what Navy SEALs do. Taking some of the tools and practices out of that intensive Praxis experience that we have built and refined over the last 5 years for hundreds and hundreds of people who have been very successful with it, and saying, what are some things we can turn into simple tools that are accessible to everybody on a software platform. So it's something that can reach millions of people at a much higher scale. and that is a much lighter touch and is much more sort of tailorable to where you're at. And so what we're starting with on Crash.co is just a simple profile to showcase your skills and ability on the job market, which is what we talk about all the time. Be your own credential. Build a body of work that speaks for you. And I'm sure we'll get more into some of this stuff. And so providing a tool that makes that very easy for people is one of the first things that we're starting with. So yeah, Crash is kind of a way to say, let's take some of the things that we've learned from doing this intensive program with people, and let's make them available to as many people as we possibly can.
Why'd you pick the word crash? I'm just curious about what the power of that word was for you.
Yeah, we actually had as we were going along and developing, what is this platform going to be? You know, it was like, okay, well, is this just something that is like a Praxis thing? Is it split out of Praxis? And the more we started to develop it and it gained its own identity, and we just realized that it's got a different strategy, a different approach, a different market. It needs an identity of its own. This is truly a separate thing. And so we split off, you know, five of us from the Praxis team went to launch Crash. And when we're going through the process, like what's a name for this thing, man, I had like probably a week of sleepless nights, and me and the team, a couple hundred name ideas ourselves. I went to Squad Help and Fiverr, a couple of websites to like do these bounties. Can anyone come up with a name? Mm-hmm. There's a total of like 350 different names, and going through, and most of all of them stunk. They were all just boring. They're all things like, you know, educate, innovate, innovate, you know, whatever, all this kind of like, you know, wordplay around. And I didn't want to be, Crash is not an education company. Crash is a career launch company. We don't care. We're agnostic on whether and to what extent you've been educated formally or informally, wherever that is, when you're ready to launch your career, that's what we want to help you with. That's what we want to provide the tools for. And so trying to move into that space, and in the career space, a lot of those names are really boring, HR sounding, you know, pro jobs, blah, blah, blah. And so I kind of had this like mental picture of an Iron Man suit of somebody going through all of these mazes and hoops and gates and gatekeepers, yeah, and kind of following the schooled mindset.
Oh, this is it. Process. Yeah. This is why I asked. Yep.
Right. Right. And like, all, you know, it's like stand in line, single file, you go to the gatekeeper, you hold up your permission slip to open one gate, you go to the next, you know, meanwhile, you're dragging this shackle of debt. You come out the other end of this labyrinth and you got your debt shackle. And there's between you and opportunity is a big chasm. It's like experience, all these things that you lack. You can't stand out in the job market. And it's like standing in line, asking permission, checking in with gatekeepers. And I thought, man, put on like an Iron Man suit and crash through the gates, crash through the wall, the maze of BS, and be your own credential. Go straight to those opportunities. And it's like, there's a lot of different metaphors with crash, you know, crashing through gatekeepers and things. I also like the party crasher idea, like standing in line, abiding by the dress code, making sure your name's on the list. No, just crash the party, coming through the side door. Like, who's having all the fun? It's the party crashers. It's the people who make their own way and they kind of bypass it. So it was a bit of a risky name because obviously crash can imply like crash and burn. But I was okay with that. I like risk. I like a name that makes you say, what is that all about for a minute? And I'm okay if it's a little risky. I like that it's short. It's one syllable. So yeah, kind of, it's like a violent collision. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. You know, sometimes you need to shake things up.
That was my first thought, that it's aggressive, right? I like that it's aggressive, and it's kind of an answer to the permission mentality that school inculcates and higher education for most people only reinforces. In fact, you know, a lot of what happens in higher education, especially in, you know, specific fields in the sciences or in medicine, it's like finishing school for the conformity and obedience that you learn in the lower levels of school. And this is about asserting and vouching for yourself. I also ask, because I'm like in the process of finding names for things myself and branding things. So I just wanted to say, I wonder what Isaac was thinking when he chose that name, but I like it.
It's really a fun process. I've gone through a handful of times, and like, it like really taxes my brain because I care a lot about that kind of stuff. but it's a really fun process. So excited to see what you come up with, Brett, for what you're working on.
Mm, indeed. Well, for Praxis, I was describing it frequently as an overpass that goes over the rotary, right? So this is not like that simple. It requires a little bit of visualization. But an overpass into a career while lots of people are kind of circling this rotary underneath.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was listening to your interview yesterday on Tom Woods, speaking of that, and Tom brought up millennial frustration and as an outcome of this frustration or maybe sense of powerlessness leading to purposelessness, they turn to left-wing politics and in many cases they kind of merge their identity with that. I think one of the problems is they become anti-capitalism because they have this old model. This is what Tom was saying. They have this old model of, you know, how capitalism works. Like you go and you earn credentials and then there's this job acquisition process. Today, everything is different, but they're still being schooled in that same model. They're getting very poor results and they're kind of turning against the whole system as a result.
It's absolutely true. And I have sympathy for the people who are like, well, you should forgive my student loans. I got ripped off. I mean, I'm not, you know, from a policy standpoint in favor of doing that,
right.
But I get it because your whole life, like these, you come out on the market, you know, you're 25 or whatever, and you've spent your whole life following the rules and getting good grades and being an honor student and doing all the things everybody around you told you. It doesn't matter. Go into debt. Doesn't matter how much. It's an investment. Don't worry about it. You know, go to school, get a good grade, blah, blah, blah. And then they're all proud of you and they all praise you. And all the signals you've gotten, all the reinforcement you've gotten your whole life is that doing these types of things are good, are praiseworthy, whatever. And by these types of things, I mean school types of things.
Right.
Like, and if you innovate, it's called like cheating, or, you know, you get banned from selling sandwiches in the lunchroom as a side business, or everything that's like innovative, entrepreneurial, experimental, you know, not good, not good. And so you come out and everything you've been told by everybody in your, you know, teachers, parents, often administrators, et cetera, you come out on the market and nobody wants to pay you. Nobody's willing to pay you for being good at all the things you were good at in school.
Right.
And your options are be mad at the market and, you know, go move back in with your parents, go work a job that you feel is beneath you, which I don't think is the right way to look at it, but, you know, go work a job that you could have worked without a degree, you know, Starbucks or whatever, or go back to school and try to become a professor, because really that's what school is best at teaching you how to do. And there's only so many jobs for those, but then there's a lot of disaffected, you know, adjunct professors or whatever, mm-hmm. who are the people that just kept going. They kept doubling down because they didn't know what else to do. And like, I get it. I mean, they have been kind of misled, you know?
Yeah. I've been trying to develop or work on a more sympathetic position because a lot of millennial political behavior is very aggravating to me, especially like when I started School Sucks back in 2009, I had such high hopes for like the generation as a whole, even though that might be a setup for a disappointment to group, you know, to put this handle on an entire group of people and say, yeah. Watch what they'll do. But I find myself at times when I'm not being careful with my thoughts, becoming this curmudgeon-y old 40-year-old old man talking about their entitlement and the laziness, the whole like, you know, in my day kind of speech.
Yep.
Like in my day, we, you know, if we wanted to watch a movie, we had to go walk the entire perimeter of Blockbuster Video, you know, and wait in a line. But I had a conversation recently with this guy, Aaron Clary, and the title of the show was as bold as, "Is it time to give up on millennials?" Because I was asking him, he wrote a blog basically answering that question in the affirmative. And, you know, I mean, there was plenty of pushback, like, that's not even a fair question to, you know, to characterize this whole generation one way. So we had, you know, a series of polite disagreements about it. But I was very open about a lot of the frustration that I feel in that process. I have kind of collectivized a little bit. So I am always looking for a more constructive approach. One of the problems is a sort of entitlement mentality. But then I think, yeah. Like, I graduated from college in the year 2000 with the most antisocial, anti-employable entitlement mentality in the world, because I had a college degree and I had these inflated expectations of what that meant as I went out and I looked for entry-level work in the communications field. And then I was reminded, this is a project that's been going on since the end of the Civil War. You know, like when you talk about dependence and getting people to stay in school longer, like this goes back to, you know, at least the beginning of the 20th century. In fact, I pulled out, I remember this line from The Underground History of American Education, Gatto's book. I'm sure you've read through that.
Oh, yeah.
And I found this paragraph I wanted to share with you. So this is just kind of diffusing my antagonism about this group of people. And this is a group of people that, you know, a lot of your work focuses on, this age group.
Yep.
To speak to the "it's nothing new," Gatto writes in the prologue for this book, "During the post-Civil War period, childhood was extended about 4 years. Later, a special label was created to describe very old children. It was called adolescence, a phenomenon hitherto unknown to the human race. The infantilization of young people didn't stop at the beginning of the 20th century. Child labor laws were extended to cover more and more kinds of work. The age of school leaving was set higher and higher. The greatest victory for this utopian project," and I think he's talking about a lot of the progressive interventions in education at the beginning of the 20th century, "was making school the only avenue to certain occupations. The intention was ultimately to draw all work into the school net. By the 1950s, by the 1950s, it wasn't unusual to find graduate students well into their 30s running errands, waiting to start their lives." By the 1950s, he says. So not a new problem.
Now, that, I always want to be super skeptical of any claim that sort of implies things are getting worse than they used to be. Now, there are things that get worse and there are things that get better, but it's too easy for our brains to be biased towards things used to be better. So whenever it starts off, you know, "Hey, this is bad. Okay, let's talk about it. Hey, this is worse than it used to be," I usually like, hold on a second. Let's hold up and analyze. It may or may not be the case. I think that's a good reminder. And on the, so I got two quick thoughts on this. One, I want to talk briefly about the next generation after millennials, which I find really exciting. And I think one of the reasons I find them exciting is, even if a lot of the problems are the same, those problems are easier to mask and get exacerbated when you have a lot of prosperity.
Right.
And when you get a little bit of tightness and the prosperity ceases a little bit, those problems can't survive as long. It's like a prosperity is like this area that gives us a larger margin for error in our, you know, whether it be in our morals or our bad understanding of causality than a less prosperous environment. And so I think there's some reasons I'm really excited about Gen Z. But real quickly on the sympathizing thing. So this is an analogy that I've used many times that I think helps sympathize with the students or graduates who feel ripped off and they feel the system let them down and they sort of wrongly blame capitalism because that's what they think the system is. But so imagine if we taught kids bike riding the way we teach them careers. So you spend 20 years of your life, the first 20 years of your life, in classrooms, learning about bikes. You'd learn about the history of bike parts. You'd draw pictures of bikes. You'd label the parts. You'd learn about the ecosystem where the rubber was made for the tires. You'd learn about how, you know, this and that type of bike is inferior and exploitative to this group. You'd learn about the cultural impacts, bikes represented in arts, bikes and men, bikes and women. You'd learn all about that. You'd never be allowed to touch one.
Right.
Certainly never be allowed to ride one. Maybe occasionally someone would bring in a bike part and demonstrate it to the class, or someone would talk about a story of someone who rode a bike once. And then after 20 years of this, everyone would say, "You are amazing. You have mastered bikes. You're going to succeed in life. Congratulations." They'd drop you off in the middle of the highway and say, "Okay, now go ride."
Yeah.
And it's like it's looked down upon to go out and actually pick up a bike and try to ride it. That's dirty. That's tawdry. What are you doing? You're dropping out of class to go work at a bakery. That's like lowly, you know, like that's how careers are treated, as like this sort of tawdry thing that you don't want to get involved in because you're doing the higher good of learning. But then it's like, well, how are you supposed to transition into the world of commerce? You know? So I feel for these people, but I do think whatever good and bad qualities that exist of millennials, I think they have a lot of good qualities. I think they're very uncompromising in a way that can come off as bad and can come off as entitled, but it's very good too. Like, they know what they want. They're like, "No, I want meaning and I want flexibility and I want fulfillment and I want a career that I'm passionate about, and I'm not going to settle. And that's a good attitude to have largely. Now, if you're out of touch with reality and you think that you can get those things without creating any value for someone, well, you might be in trouble. But here's where I'm excited about Gen Z or whatever they're called, the next generation, because millennials are kind of getting old now and people just use the phrase to refer to like young people generally.
Sure. They can be up to 37, I think, at this point.
Right. Yeah. And if you're like 20 and younger, early 20s and younger, that's sort of this new generation. And I'm not just talking about like what demographers would say. There's a distinctive, there's a cultural difference. I'll never forget. I was giving lectures for years. I've lectured for the Foundation for Economic Education at their college and high school seminars. And at some point, about 5 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, I was lecturing at a high school seminar. And that was the first time. And I'd been doing this for about 5 years at that point. These kids were so different. When I kind of made my case, this was my shocking, controversial final talk where I imply that college might be a waste. Right. And I'm used to everybody just being like, what? You're crazy, blah, blah, blah. Get to the Q&A. All the kids were like, yeah, no, that makes sense. It was like so easy. And they weren't mad. They weren't pro-college. They weren't anti-college. They were just very, very pragmatic. And I've noticed with this generation, kids kind of 15 to 20 range, like these teens and early 20s, they have a much less entitled attitude. They have a much more pragmatic attitude. They're not as nihilistic as like Gen X. Gen X is like, oh, probably no one's going to pay me to do anything. Blah, blah, blah. Like they kind of are nihilistic about it. This generation's like, look, no one owes me anything. No, I'm not going to just automatically, they don't believe that they will automatically be better off than their parents. And millennials did, because their parents were better off than their grandparents, who were better off than theirs. Basically, since the Depression, every generation, even if you were lazy and you were a worse person than your parents, you would end up making more money than them, like because the economy was just growing. And I think after the 2008 crash and in the next decade, a lot of kids are worse off than their parents were financially, at least by their own perception. Now they have access to technologies and things, and you could definitely argue quality of life is better.
Right.
But in terms of the things that they look at, owning a home, being financially independent, whatever, and that came as a shock to them because they believed it was automatic. And they believed if you followed the rules, it was automatic. And if you got a degree, automatically you'd get a good job and a business card and people would respect you and you'd have a house and a boat and two kids. And when that stopped happening, I think this Gen Z, they saw that. They saw their older siblings or these kids moving back home into the basement. And they said, huh, well, I don't think I want that. So like, maybe I just won't go into debt. They're very, very pragmatic. They're a little bit more tinkering, enterprising. There's something there that's a little more grounded that I'm incredibly bullish on.
What do you attribute that to? Like what trends or forces?
I mean, I really think that reality is just the best lesson. I think right. I think the collapse of the housing bubble in 08 was the main spark. And then just the continued inflation of college degrees and things and the decreasing returns are just more and more obvious. And so I just think seeing the practical economic realities and also having access to a higher level of, I would say, like a maker mentality and a higher level of customization. So you kind of, you're accustomed to, like, they've never had the experience of there only being, you know, 5 radio stations that we all listen to. In fact, they've never even had the experience of there only being a whole bunch of things to stream and listen to. They've always had the experience that music is something you can choose, pick and choose, and you can create. You can actually participate in the creation of it. That's never been seen as weird to this generation.
Oh, absolutely.
So there's kind of like a maker mentality in there, a tinkerer mentality because of the tools available, combined with a better grasp on reality that the market doesn't just reward you for being human.
Right. Yeah. I mean, so I'm even experiencing that over the course of my life. Like you and I are in the same ballpark age-wise. We grew up with a handful of TV channels, right? Maybe like 2 ways to get the news through the TV and then a radio station and a couple of newspapers. Like that was the case when I became aware of the world around me. I'm getting news today from some dude who's filming to YouTube from his bedroom, you know, like somebody like Tim Pool.
Yep.
You know?
And you can not only get that, you can record a response to it.
Exactly.
And post it. And participate actively in the conversation. The consumption act is way more closely linked to the creation act in a continuous feedback loop, which is pretty awesome.
Right. So I think because of schooling and maybe a lot of the pressures, even these kids who are in their early 20s are still getting caught in that school to higher education net. But like their worldview, having never known anything else, having never experienced the excitement of having their television go from 9 channels to 27 channels, and then cable comes and goes to 100 channels, and it's like, oh my God, what am I going to – I'm set for life. You know,
Right.
Like always living in this world of makers and doers and independent, these independent forces, more of them as a result of that will turn away from or get out of that net, I think is a better way of thinking about it.
And look, I'm a parent and I understand parenting is incredibly hard, and it's very hard to not project on your kids, to not try to make your kids do things that, you know, make you look good to your friends and not, don't embarrass you, instead of what's good for your kids. So I say this knowing that, but parents are by far the biggest problem. They're the biggest problem, even the really well-meaning parents. I'll tell you, when we started Praxis 5 years ago, trying to convince a young person to take a chance on a year-long program to defer college or don't go to college or whatever, it was quite a conversation because they were like a little worried, whatever. Fast forward to today. It is no problem. Kids come to us and they're already like, yeah, I get it. College isn't going to help me with my career. I want to do Praxis.
Right.
The kids are like, they get it. They 100% get it. It's a piece of cake. Their parents haven't moved hardly at all.
Sure.
Their parents are very, it's always the parent that's the problem. And it's because of, it's a desire for prestige.
Right.
It's not because their parent really, really has thought through the ROI and what's good for their kid and what their kid wants and what makes them happy. It's because they really don't want to be embarrassed at the cocktail party when they say, oh yeah, Joey's not going to college. He dropped out. It's like, well, that signals to the world that you didn't complete your job as a parent. Whereas if you're like, oh, Joey's in college, he got into a good school. It doesn't matter if Joey's depressed, alcoholic, his girlfriend left him, he has no job prospects, no skills. You will be praised. Mm-hmm. Because if he goes on to be a failure in life after that, they'll say, well, you can't blame you. It was the economy. It was forces out of your control. You did everything you could. You got him into a good school. It's not your fault. But if Joey doesn't go to college, it doesn't matter how successful he is. Other parents will look at you like you failed somehow. It's truly a bizarre. This is why I think it's reached a religious status. Because I mean, yeah. I literally talk to parents who are like worried and mad at their kid who runs a business and is loving life and making 60 grand and never went to college, and proud of their other child who graduated with honors and moved back home and can't get a job and is depressed.
No, I mean, case in point, I hate to, like I said, the whole college admissions scandal thing wasn't particularly interesting to me. I felt like it was just a chance for America, you know, mainstream America, to learn the phrase college is a scam. Most people had never, or college scam, finger quotes. Most people had never said that before. But here you have the daughter of Aunt Becky from Full House. I'm sorry, I forget what the actress's name is, making 6 figures a year, putting makeup on, you know, on Instagram, and has obviously a pretty significant network. So already all kinds of doors are open to this person, this young girl who's also found her own way to already be successful. What does USC, you know, going and studying communications at USC have to offer? Nothing.
It's not about careers. And we like to laugh at those celebrities, but it's honestly the same motivation for all other parents.
Agreed. Yeah.
They don't sit down and break down, well, what do you actually want to do? Okay. What's the best path to get there? Should you try this for a few years? Should you try this? What does it require a degree? It's like, just get the degree because I'll feel good about you. It kind of reminds me of, I grew up in the church, and anybody who grew up in a Christian church is probably familiar with this phenomenon, right? Like, even though people mean well and they genuinely want you to be like a good Bible believing Christian who's doing well, everything becomes shortcutted to the point of absurdity, to where, so you're just using signals. Well, I can't really take the time to know how you're doing. So if I see that you show up to church every Sunday, I'll use that as a signal that you're doing okay and that you're still a good Christian. And then eventually I'll just be like, you know, hey, as long as you have the bumper sticker of the Christian radio station on there, or as long as you listen to the right kind of music, I'll just assume. And pretty soon, signals upon signals, and there's no substance at all. And it's like, as long as you say, you know, oh, you moved to a new town, you're going to church, as long as you say yes, then everybody's like, good, you're awesome. And you could be like going to church and like you know, a horrible, horrible person, but they're okay. But if you say no, maybe you're like deeply studying the Bible and very devout, but you're just not going to a church, people will freak out and they don't want to hear it. Like, because these things become proxies and they become superstitions, where it's like, you just do the performative thing and there's no content behind it. And I think that's where it's gotten with degrees.
I totally agree. Perfect segue into the meat of this conversation. And I guess we could look at this as a contrast between facade signals, right? A facade signal is like a Facebook post. Look at me, I'm on a boat. How did I get here? What an interesting story. Or look at me, I have a bachelor's degree in anthropology, right? But what you're talking about in this new book called Crash Your Career, what you guys have been talking about at Praxis for years is sort of deep substantive signals that are also easy to track. So the subtitle of Crash Your Career is Ditch the Gatekeepers and Be Your Own Credential. Instead of, or, you know, Zach's idea, I think Zach first introduced this phrase on the show 3 years ago, where he said, we need to build a better credential than the college degree. So Crash Your Career is a very short, but you could read it in like a matter of an hour, this step-by-step guidebook to how to do this. And then obviously you have to fill in the details of how you, the reader, the individual reader, do this. But let's actually talk about that process of signaling from, I guess we could start at this problem, this entitlement mentality that, you know, our generation was subjected to, that obviously millennials are struggling with. We in college reinforces, right? We finish high school, or even more true, we finish college and we feel like we are entitled to a work with a job with a very reasonable starting salary. I was devastated the first time I used my college degree to get a job and learned what the yearly salary was. You know, it was I said so. I told this story recently on the show, but I said so in the negotiation. Like, but I have so much debt. How is this the starting salary? Like, I guess I didn't have very good tact at the time, but I actually said something like that to the CEO of the company when they were hiring me. It was a marketing job at a ski resort. So let's talk about one of the best tips in this short book is the willingness, or embracing the willingness, to do free work.
Yeah. So when you think about how do you get opportunities in the market? And first, you need to be able to solve a problem for somebody to create value for them. And then you need to be able to prove it. And a lot of market transactions are really about information. Information is costly to obtain. People are always trying to get better information. Because if I put out a job posting, I'll get 100 people to apply, but I got to choose which one to hire. And that the process of sifting through that information and interpreting what it means is a very high cost process. And so if you go out there with an entitlement idea that, like, hey, I've got a degree, here you go, it's up to the employer to do all the work of figuring out why I'm worth hiring and whether I'm worth hiring and for what amount and whatever.
Right.
And then you get mad if they don't do it. I think you're missing the cost to them of even knowing about you. So I actually don't think most people, there's like skills gaps and people aren't very good at a lot of things. But given how big an opportunity rich the economy is, I think almost everybody has enough skills. In fact, everybody has enough skills in something that someone else values that they could get paid for it and probably paid a decent amount. But it's a lot of work for you to figure out what that is and for somebody else to find you and to find out what that is from you. And so the whole idea of be your own credential is, as fewer and fewer people trust sort of a third party stamp of approval, you need to find a way to do something that's hard to fake. That's difficult to fake. You can game the system and buy a degree, right? And that's easy to fake. So it doesn't carry much weight. But can you do something that's hard to fake, right? You can fake that you own a boat by posting a picture of you on a boat on Instagram, right? Like, to use your example.
I've done it. Yeah, sure.
Can you do something that's hard to fake that demonstrates your ability? And I think that's a really good way to think about, you know, credentializing yourself, your own skills. And so why free work is such an amazing way to do this is because it's impossible, almost impossible to fake. Almost no one else does it. So you have like no competition, and it immediately reduces the information costs, the search costs to the person looking at hiring you. If you come to me and say, here's my resume, you interpret it and try to think through whether or not it's going to make me good at, let's say, you know, doing sales calls for you or doing cold emails to a bunch of people for a sales job.
Right.
That's a lot of work you're asking me to do. If instead you come to me and say, hey, I found this list of 100 prospects I put together who might be good for your product. I went ahead and drafted this cold email and I sent it all to them. And like, don't worry, I didn't say that I worked for you or whatever, but I experimented with this. Here's the results of my experiment. Or, hey, I just went and built this list of prospects. You can have it, right? You can use it if you want to do sales for them. I'd love to do more stuff like this for you. Now you have lowered the cost to me of trying to understand how you as a human person in the universe, in the abstract, might specifically be good at solving my problem because you've showed me yourself solving that specific problem. Hey, this is the job you want to hire me for. I went ahead and did it ahead of time. Mm. Now you know my ability to do the job. And there's something about that that is so powerful. In the very least, it's going to be very hard for me to ignore you. I'm going to be so impressed because it's so rare. Even if I don't think you're the person for the job, I'm probably going to respond. I'm probably going to tell you thank you. I'm probably going to pass you along to a few other people.
If you don't
I'm probably
need
going
that
to be willing
thing.
To be a reference for you.
Right.
It's very powerful.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, in the book you also talk about comparative advantage. And we talked about both of these processes when it was looking for somebody to mentor you, right? Instead of actually seeking employment or a path to employment. But you mentioned a few minutes ago, like, if you're good at something, you know, with comparative advantage, the difference between like what your opportunity cost is and somebody else's, right? So like, even if you're not as good as the person you want to work for, you want to, even if you just want that door to be open, if you have the time to do something and your time is worth doing that thing, well, like the CEO of some company, his time is obviously not, like his hour could be much better spent on some simple baseline kind of task. You do that thing and that's a way to open a door.
That's exactly right. That's something that is so empowering to remember. I mean, I've had people work for me, you know, so I've had various podcasts through the years. I've got Office Hours podcast now with TK Coleman. And when I started, I learned how to do audio editing and whatever, and I could do it pretty fast. I'm not like amazing at it or anything. And somebody came on, a young person was like, hey, I want to do your podcast publication, like editing and stuff for you. I'll do it for free. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, well, that's hard to say no to. Go ahead. It probably took them 5 times longer than it took me, but it didn't matter because I was like, cool, they're doing it for free. This frees me up, right? And then even when they said, hey, I want to get paid for this, I was like, awesome. I started paying them. And again, their opportunity cost, the other next best thing they could be doing was like, you know, bagging groceries or something else that didn't pay a lot either. And that wasn't really learning any skills for them or building a network. So for them, they weren't missing out on much by doing this even for free for a few months or at low pay.
Right.
For me, being freed up for that hour was huge. And so that's an awesome way to enter the market to say, how can I make it? And again, this is not about being exploited because you're trying to do something to make it hard for someone to say no to you. And it's an investment in yourself. So I've gotten this, hey, free work is exploitation argument many, many times from people. Yeah. And this is kind of the entitlement approach. Like, well, I'm not going to do, I applied for a job one time and they asked me to do an assignment before they even, it was going to take me 5 hours and they weren't even going to pay me for it. And there's no guarantee I'm going to get the job. Well, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to be exploited. Okay. I probably have more points than I want. I don't know how deep you want to go down to this. I got like 5-point rebuttal to the exploitation thing.
Go for it. Let's get it in there. Yeah, sure. Of course.
Okay. So a couple thoughts on that. Because I think this is really, really important. This is really important to be clear-headed about. This is not about being a martyr and just, I'll just say yes to everything. No. This is an empowering way. Free work is empowering. Okay. So first, when people say, if you do free work for people, you're being exploited. I've never met someone who's actually done it, who walked away being like, yeah, I feel like I was exploited. Someone who's gone out of their way, made a project, pitched somebody. Every person I've met, and I've talked to dozens, if not 100 or more, who have utilized this, they come away feeling excited and empowered, even if they don't get the job. So it's usually a concern about theoretical man. I like to call the internet is all about concern about theoretical man.
Right.
Well, this might work for you, but what about someone that I can imagine somewhere who this wouldn't work for and they'd be exploited, right? Like I've never run into a real case. Okay. The next thing is everybody obsesses over what does the company get? Well, if I do free work, they're getting something from me, right? Now, first of all, they're getting a lot less than you think. no matter how good you do a project when you don't work for someone, you're not going to have enough context and knowledge to do a really, really great project. It's not as valuable as you think it is.
Right, the reason
that they value it is because it shows your willingness to do it. It shows the kind of thing you can do. It's not because the specific thing they did for you is so valuable. It's that it shows what kind of person you are. So, but forget what the company gets. Let's say they get some wonderful benefit for free. Ha ha. And they're rubbing their hands together. Be more selfish. Not about what they get. What do you get? So people are so blinded by their hatred of companies trying to make money that they miss out. They're so blinded by hatred of companies that they miss out on what would benefit them. This is an investment in yourself. If you want to get a job, if you want to get hired, what are the ways to increase the probability of making it happen? And here's a way that would do that. Who cares if it benefits the company? That's irrelevant. It benefits you even more. So like, think more about what you get out of it. Don't be so concerned about what they may or may not get about it.
Right.
Okay. There's another thing that comes up that I hear sometimes that, well, this is a really bad precedent. If you start off the relationship by being like, I hear I did some free work for you, you establish a master-slave relationship. Nothing could be further from the truth. This is the opposite. The employee who comes to you and says, hey, I know you didn't ask for it, but I went ahead and made this and did this and did this and this, and I anticipated this need and I created this for you. Here you go.
Yeah, exactly. Why would one person be the master in that situation? Looks like somebody
took it. They're the employee that you want to say, you want to give the maximum freedom to. You want to say, I want to let you run. I respect you as a peer. I want to give you all kinds of responsibility and freedom. The employee that says, I'm not doing a thing until you pay me for it and I'm doing exactly the minimum required. That's somebody who signals wage slave. That's somebody who signals treat me like a cog because that's how I see myself.
Right, exactly.
It's the opposite, you know? And then the final thought is just, maybe I have two final thoughts, that it really is just information, right? Free work is information. It's a way of marketing yourself. So if you're out there on the market and you're saying, I'm going to try to get you to pay attention to me, well, I could do it with a resume. That's a very bad form of marketing that no one's going to pay attention to. Or I could do it with a project. That's a really good form of marketing that is going to give me results, right? So if it's exploitation to do free work, then companies are being exploited constantly. Every time they create an advertisement for you on TV and don't make you pay for it and try to entertain you, every time they give you a free sample, they're being exploited. Every time they say, hey, you want to buy this product? Come check it out. Try it. Look at it. They're being exploited, right? If companies took the same approach that these kind of like anti-exploitation advocates take, it'd be like, you can't look at, touch, sniff, or smell, or read anything about the product until you pay me the money.
Right.
You'd be like really suspicious of that, right? So it's just a form of marketing. And then the final thing is just an irony. I mean, how ironic is it, Brett, that people, it's almost always the same people who will say free work, telling people to go intern for free or whatever, you're being exploited. They all see education as an investment. They see spending 5 years paying somebody tens of thousands of dollars for the privilege of not earning a dime and not gaining any relevant skills. That's a good thing.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's crazy. It's absolutely crazy. So anyway, that was a bit of a tangent, but I think it's worth really hammering home and saying, look, this is about you gaining the best opportunity you can. And even if you don't get the job that you put together a project or pitch for, what you'll learn by putting it together and the likelihood that that will help you get another job is tremendous. One good project is going to be worth more than sending out 50 generic resumes.
I think one of the obstacles that a lot of young people run into here is they don't understand the value of the information they can get, because early on in people's careers, they haven't found a passion yet. You know what I mean? So yeah. Like they are, in many cases, they might have something they like to do, or they might have motivating career goals, but without some accumulated success of doing something, they might not be able to realize the true value of the information they're getting for free in exchange for work for free. And I know like free isn't even the right word anymore. There's definitely a value exchange happening there. That might be one of the obstacles.
Yeah, it definitely is. It's hard to understand how valuable an opportunity is until you have enough context to sort of see it, right? Mm-hmm. So like I've seen young people pass up an amazing, hey, this person wants me to come work for them for a year or for a summer. And they're like a CEO with tons of experience and they're starting their third company from the ground up and it's low pay and it's hard to know where the company will go and whatever. And so the young person looks at it and they're like, there's no title. The pay isn't high. There's no security. There's no benefit. They're thinking of things that their parents would have thought about in like factory jobs or whatever. And they're like, I could do that. Yeah. But, or I could go back to school and finish this semester.
Yeah.
And it's like with perspective, you're like, no, you don't understand. Being around this person who has built companies before, spending 3 months, 6 months, whatever, working with them, learning from them, like this is incalculably valuable. This is unbelievably valuable. There's nothing that you're going to get sitting in a sociology class that's going to help you at all. This is amazing. And it's hard to see that sometimes. So I think if you can just sort of simplify the process a little bit when you're young and say, first of all, I don't need to find my passion.
Yeah.
Like if I know it, great, but I don't need to. That's almost always a distraction and it's really, really stressful. What I need to do is say, what's the best opportunity that's real and tangible in front of me right now for the next 6 months, 1 year, 2 years, somewhere in that time frame? I wouldn't look much beyond 2 years. I would look in the kind of 6 months to 24 months range. What's the best next step in terms of, and by best, I would optimize for learning, not for earning. I would optimize for where's a place where I'm going to be exposed to a lot of interesting people, a lot of interesting ideas, business practices, parts of, you know, company operations and functions. I might learn what it means to do marketing, what it means to do finance and accounting. If I can just be around people who are doing it, right? You learn what's possible by being around it. You learn what kind of careers exist by bumping into the world and experimenting. And if you can sort of remove the stress of like, I've got to find a path and plot it out and find my passion, don't worry about that. If a good opportunity comes and you don't hate it and you don't absolutely suck at it, and it's valuable to somebody enough for them to give you an opportunity there, take it.
Yeah.
Take it until you either start to hate it or start to suck at it or a better opportunity comes along.
Yeah.
That's it. Take it and keep riding it until one of those things changes, because you don't have enough information to know and to sit there with analysis paralysis. Well, if I take this, there could be something theoretical out there that could be better. Well, it's not on the table right now. So take the best thing in front of you where you're going to learn things and get out into the world and experiment and gather more information. And if you learn after 6 months that you hate it, and I would give it a little bit of time because you might hate it at first, give it a little time, but learn if you hate it, learn if you suck at it, or learn if there's something better that comes along and then jump onto that. But just take it a step at a time.
Right. And focus on the learning. I think it goes back to what we were talking about earlier with the signaling, the superficial versus the substantive, right? So a person comes into this situation, they say, what's the pay? What's the position? You know, the title? Where's the office? What are the benefits? Those are the questions, right? It's sort of like the next step of dependence and not realizing the unseen benefits of participating in something like that. So when ultimately in this conversation, we're building up to the effective signaling of acquired skills. Let's spend a little bit more time on this question of the decision-making process, especially when somebody's like, you know, teens, early 20s, how to decide what skills to pursue. And I think it almost, in a way, it kind of comes back to the generational thing where over the 20th century, we've gone from survival to success to like a purpose-driven life. Like that's sort of been the progression. My grandparents were, you know, like, I hope I don't have to boil my shoes for sustenance to survive, to I hope I don't get killed by Hitler, to my parents being like, I hope I don't, you know, die in a nuclear war. Even like right up until I was a child, like that was a threat. But then out of the survival mindset, and we've watched this in the modern world, leaving the survival mindset into the success focus, which was obviously huge in the 80s and the 90s, and now into this more purpose-driven life. And a lot of people, I think it's understanding that for millennials, even though a lot of them have, unfortunately, I think it's true with my generation too, swapped politics for an intrinsically motivated purpose, even if that might just be a temporary detour. That's something that's happening. People are in a rush to find that passion, right? And definitely, you mentioned it already in this conversation, but you advise against that in the book. But from there, let's just reiterate that and talk about how do people discover like an intersection point of, you know, what do you like to do? What can you do? And then the most important component of that, what would people appreciate you doing?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. What would they be willing to pay you for, hopefully.
Right.
Yeah. So I like the progression that you sort of laid out for, you know, kind of society at going from kind of moving up Maslow's hierarchy, you know, from survival to whatever, protection and security to, you know, meaning and eventually like actual self-actualization. And I think on an individual level, it's useful to think of that. I don't think it's helpful to try to skip a bunch of steps or take a bunch of steps for granted. Mm. So even though we live in a very wealthy society with a very sizable safety net, and I don't mean like government policy safety net, just in general, like failure in the United States today, it doesn't look that bad. Like you're probably not going to starve. And so that's good, but I don't think you should just take the first several layers of that hierarchy of human needs for granted and say, you know, I'm 17, I'm working on life self-actualization.
Right.
It's
right,
like, yeah, no, hold on. You have relied on your parents or other forces around you for survival and security and socialization and whatever other things before you get to self-actualization. You need to first become an independent provider of those things for yourself. So don't worry about the fulfillment component yet. Don't do things that you hate. I think that's the best heuristic. Don't do stuff you hate, right? Don't do stuff that's actively deadening your soul.
Right.
If you truly know that it's like making sucking meaning from your life, then don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
But otherwise, don't worry about it. Do the things that are going to benefit you in learning how to survive, how to become more valuable, how to gain a little bit of security, gain a little bit of confidence. And don't try to over-optimize so much for meaning because you're not going to be able to do it. You just don't have enough information. You're going to learn that as you go along. So I think in terms of identifying skills, like overthinking the process is the biggest trap most people fall into. They're afraid of getting pigeonholed. They're afraid of picking the wrong skill.
Right.
And I don't think it matters. It's very playful and experimental. Like, if you think something is kind of interesting to you, or you've done it and you didn't hate it and it was okay, and you've seen that other people seem to be talking about it, you know, SEO, say, search engine optimization, you hear people talk about it, you know that businesses value showing up in a Google result, you kind of don't hate that kind of stuff, you like tinkering around, then instead of like sitting there and doing this giant, you know, cost benefit analysis of all the skills you could use, say, okay, I'm going to do that and give yourself a bounded challenge. Okay, I'm going to master SEO in 30 days. I'm going to go and dive in, gain everything I can, and I'm going to do some kind of project that demonstrates my ability. I'm going to set up a simple landing page and I'm going to see if I can get it to show up on the in the first three pages of results on Google for some kind of obscure search term. And I'm going to learn everything I can and use that as my final outcome to showcase what I learned about SEO and dive in and learn it. And like, what's the worst that happens if you lose yourself in nothing but SEO for a month and become a reasonable master at it? I mean, in a month, you can be more competent than 95% of the population at it. What's the worst that can happen? Even if you go on to do accounting, an accountant who has SEO skills, oh, that's really interesting.
Oh,
that's
yeah,
a good signal.
Yeah.
That's a valuable intersection. Even if you never use those SEO skills down the road, you haven't just learned SEO, you've learned how to master something. You've learned how to learn quickly. You've learned how to pick something and go get it. And so I would not stress too much about what it is. I would just start to look for a couple things and then just pick one and be like, I'll start here and I'm going to go master this and build something around it. And over time, you'll get better at picking things that are more and more aligned to the unique skill set you have as you learn what is unique to you and what is the market value that you bring. But don't overthink it, man. You can't really go wrong. Like if you master something, that's not going to harm you, you know?
Yeah. And the accumulating those successes, back to your example, it's, you know, a little different, but it's related to, you know, getting credentialed in bike riding versus actually learning how to ride a bike, right? You accumulate small step-by-step successes that lead to an outcome, right? That might be more passion, passion-oriented, passion-focused. It's probably going to change as you gain experience and skill anyway, right? There's no how to predict that path at the beginning.
Yeah, though there is nothing more valuable than confidence. And it's one of the first things that you need to build. And so the way you build it is just by doing, by getting wins, right? Get some small wins under your belt and then you can move up to bigger and wins. And it doesn't even matter what you win at so much. If it's like something real that you did, you engaged with the world. So like, hey, I created an email newsletter and I got 100 people to sign up for that thing. Mm. You're going to feel really awesome. And you're going to be like, I can do stuff. Right. And you're going to take that with you to other stuff. It's not so much that, oh, well, the market's not going to value someone who has 100 people on their email list. No, nobody cares about an email list of 100, but they care about people who have the belief that they can do stuff. And when you set out to get some subscribers on an email list and you did it, that gave you some confidence that translates everywhere and that will make you more able to learn other skills. So just start picking some stuff to go after.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you use this example when you're talking about building skills in the book. Promise a friend you'll create a logo for his website in 2 weeks, you know, that kind of a thing versus like looking out into the fog of, you know, something with some gravity.
Yeah, being like, oh, I'm sort of artistic. Maybe I'd be interested in graphic design. I'll think about, and I'll look up salaries for graphic designers, and I'll look up programs, and I'll think about, how about you say, hey, I'm going to make a logo for you. Here you go. I did it in 7 days. Now I'll try it again. Right? Like that's how you explore that interest. Mm,
absolutely. So let's talk a little bit more about like once this acquisition process, and this acquisition process is obviously ongoing, even once you learn how to signal these skills, and even once you have success signaling these skills, and even once there's desirable outcomes from doing that, that is a continuous process of improvement, hopefully for most people. But yep. Let's talk about resumes.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, you've got kind of the four phases here with the skills relevant to your career launch.
Right.
You know, choosing, which we talked about, don't overthink the choosing process. Building, which signaling and selling. And building and signaling, I think, ought to go very, very hand in hand. So right. What do I mean by this? So the process of acquiring the skill, in my mind, it's done best when it's some kind of real world context and some kind of project. So like we just used the example, instead of, hey, I studied graphic design, I read about it. No, I actually did a project where I made a logo for somebody. That's a project-based process of learning, but it has the added benefit of providing a signal as the outcome. So you can say, absolutely. Here, look at the logo I built. Here, look at the email list I built. Here, look at the search results for the website I built. And so if you can package the building and signaling into a single sort of project-based or experience-based process, you're going to get a massive bang for your buck. Because even if you know, let's say data analytics, you learned the skill, you acquired it. If you did it in the way that I think schools usually do things, which is kind of like a black box approach, it's all behind closed doors and like one single expert reviews your work and certifies you. But the rest of the world doesn't know what it means that you got an A in that if you have nothing tangible to show for it.
Right.
And so if you can combine the acquisition with something that produces a tangible signal as the outcome, you're going to get that double bang where you can say, I have a high level of skill in data analytics, and here is my proof. You don't have to take my word for it. You don't have to take anybody else's word for it either. You can look at the proof itself. You can look at the result, you know, sort of my body of work. And that's what, you know, with Crash, we're providing this skills profile for people to do this, to showcase their body of work, to demonstrate, hey, I know this software. Here's me proving it. Hey, I've got this skill set. Here's me proving it. And I think if you translate everything into, if you ask yourself the question, how would I prove this? If someone never met me, if they didn't trust my word, if they didn't trust a stamp of approval I got, if they thought I could fake a test, how would I give them some proof of this skill that would make them say, oh, wow. I mean, like your podcast is proof, Brett, that you have a certain skill set. I can go and look and see that you've produced 600 and some podcasts. You obviously are good at research. You obviously have some level of organization skills and consistency. You obviously have communication skills. Like I can learn so much about you because there's this huge body of work that you've produced out there to back up certain assumptions I might make about you. And if you just sent me a bullet point list on a resume and said, good communication skills, data editing, you know, audio editing skills, blah, 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 research skills, I'd be like, okay, well, he says so, but what does that mean?
Right.
And so that I think that's really, really crucial.
Yeah, the other thing is the tracking process. And I noticed this with, I think every single person that I've talked to affiliated with Praxis at some point, most of them are still maintaining it, but at some point did some kind of like a blogging challenge where they would blog every single day, you know? And yep. And this seems to be, isn't this, I think I remember Nick saying this to me, Nick Runlett, who is a Praxis graduate, saying, you know, this is part of the program. Is that you do something like this. You record your work, your progress, your learning endeavors.
Absolutely. In fact, that it is an integral part of the Praxis experience, and it goes all the way back to the origin of the company. TK Coleman had started daily blogging. He had given himself this challenge to do it for a year. And in that year, I saw him transform into a like hyper productive creative force. I mean, he was always a smart guy, always well-read, always very interesting, curious. He just started to do so much more, and it was inspiring to me. And I had a job that I loved, making good money and whatever. And I just told him, like, I'm in kind of a rut. Like, I'm itchy. I need a new challenge. I need something. And he's like, you're not creating enough, man. He's like, you need to blog every day. So he talked me into it. So I started doing it. About 3 months into that daily blogging challenge, I was so overflowing with ideas and inspiration and confidence by just every day hitting publish, starting the day with an act of creation, that my mind went into hyperdrive. Creating begets creating. And the idea for Praxis actually emerged out of this creative explosion that was kicked off by daily blogging. And so when we were going through various iterations of the program, we just baked that in as like, hey, here's this challenge, this 30-day blogging challenge. Almost nobody can do this. If you do this, you set yourself apart. It's not so much about becoming a better writer. You'll become a better writer, but that's not really the main thing. If you can hit publish every day in something that can be viewed publicly, the number of things, internal impediments to progress that you have to overcome to be able to do that would blow your mind. People are like, whether they're perfectionists, that they're too embarrassed to have something seen by people, that they just wrote in 20 minutes, you've got to overcome that. Don't be precious, right? Whether you have this overconfidence that you think everyone's going to love your stuff and you click publish and it gets 5 views, you got to deal with that and still show up the next day and not be too ashamed and embarrassed. If you click publish and 100 people show up and they don't like it and you have a hard time not being liked by people or not taking criticism,
right,
you got to deal with that. The number of things that just showing up every single day and doing something like that, it's such a low barrier, but I have never seen it not transform somebody. It's amazing what it does for the confidence as Praxis participants go through it. So that's just one example. That's something that's hard to fake. It's rare. And if you completed it, it demonstrates certain qualities of sort of your soft skills and character that are highly valued. We had a vice president of sales one time say, yeah, I looked at one of your guys. He had no sales experience, no degree. I didn't really know whether he'd be good at sales, but I saw he blogged, hey, I just finished a 60-day blog challenge. I blogged every day for 60 days. And he goes, and I went and scanned through his blog and he did it. He goes, hardly anybody can do that. If you can show up every day and do that, then you can show up every day and do sales. And right, that's a resilient person. And I immediately was hooked.
Okay, let's dig into your experience with that, because that is absolutely, I love that idea. What were your rules for yourself when you did this? You said you were, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you were feeling more inert, more uninspired than usual. You brought that idea to TK and he said to do this.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So,
but then just to sit there in front of the keyboard on day one, how did you get through that?
Yeah. So I have this problem where I get the itch, like I need newness, I need new challenges, sure, and stuff. And so I was just, everything about my job, my life was awesome. Everything about it was great. There was no reason to not like it, but it was like, I wanted something more. And TK was like, look, man, like you used to play music and write songs back in the day. You have no outlet for that stuff anymore. And you just need to start creating. And I'm like, well, I don't know. Someday I want to write a book. And you know, all these kind of like, someday everybody says they want to write a book. You know, maybe I'll start playing music again when the kids are older and they're not so much work. And he's like, all that stuff is too high of a barrier, so you won't do it. Just do something that you would have to be like, you have no excuse to not blog every day because there's no requirement of how long it is. Nobody has to read it, whatever. You just click publish every day. There's no excuse but your own BS.
So were you setting any kind of guidelines for yourself?
So I didn't. I like to keep things as simple as possible. I don't trust, the more brain power is involved in an activity, the less likely I am to do it or succeed at it. I want to make it so stupidly simple that like, I don't need to think about it. And so all I said was, okay, TK, I'm going to do this for 6 months. And by the way, and this was about 6 years ago, I've blogged every day for periods of 6 months or a year, almost the whole time. I've taken various breaks at 3 months off here and there to experiment with other things, but I'm daily blogging right now. I post a blog post every single day on my blog. It just changed my life so much that like, why would I give it up? So all I did was say, okay, for 6 months, TK's thrown down the gauntlet. Fine. If he can do it, I can do it. I'm not going to let him beat me. I mean, come on. So I said, all I'm going to do is publish something on my blog every day for 6 months. That's the only rule. Every single day, something goes up. So I didn't even give myself rules when I began. Like, I don't have to write something every day. If one day I write three posts and schedule it for the next 3 days, fine.
Gotcha.
As long as something gets published every day. It doesn't have to be any particular length. Doesn't have to be any particular topic. I even let myself republish. If I had written something long ago that never got published, I would go and publish it as a blog post. Like that, I would do those sometimes. Those were like little cheat days, but I didn't get more complicated than that. Something shows up on my blog every single day for 6 months. And most of the time I would sit down and write it. And something really like amazing happens by starting easy, where I had kind of a backlog of some short little things I'd written. Sometimes I just do a haiku or something stupid. Sometimes I just be like, hey, this is a really neat article I saw and here's a link to it. By letting myself get away with basically anything, as long as I published it, I started to gain that confidence. And I started to find that the days when I sat down and wrote something fresh, I felt better. I loved it. I felt awesome. It felt good. So I started to do that more. And now it's to the point where I have no backlog. I have no drafts in there. Every morning I show up with a blank screen. I have no idea what I'm going to write. And I sit there and I look out the window for a couple minutes. I think about something that I was talking to somebody about. And then I just start writing. And it might be a paragraph. And it might be five paragraphs. But when I began, I would use some kind of triggers like, okay, what's something that makes me mad? Or, okay, let me scan at my bookshelf.
Right.
What's like an idea from one of these books that I like? Or, you know what? I've read like tons of books. I've never reviewed any of them. What if I wrote, and I would give myself constraints to make it easier. So like if you have an unconstrained, like, okay, write a review of Human Action. Well, that's like the most life-changing book for me. It's massive. It's full of ideas. That's so unconstrained. It's overwhelming.
Right.
But if I said, write a review of Human Action that's no longer than 200 words. Oh, okay. That constraint actually makes it easier. I've got to like do the distilled version, right? And it doesn't feel like this once and for all magnum opus on my thoughts on Human Action. So I would play little games like that with myself just to make sure something got out the door every day and it just began to compound. You know, it's like when people ask me, like, I'm thinking about starting a podcast. What equipment should I use? How long should it be? What should the format be? What should the theme be? What should the name be? And I'm like, stop all that. Get half a dozen episodes recorded.
Yeah.
Don't worry about having a name, a theme, anything. Just record 6 episodes. And then by the end of that, you'll probably have a much clearer idea what you want to call it, how you want to bring it into the world. Just start creating and let it refine itself along the way.
Exactly. Yeah. Maybe that was one of the reasons why it was the one thing that I didn't overthink, right? I had too many ideas bottlenecked back, 10 years ago when I started doing this, that it did. I went to Radio Shack and bought a microphone that was $10. You know, I knew it wasn't the optimal. I'd been in a radio studio before. I knew this was not the optimal setup, but I just started doing it. And then when people started complaining, when people gave me feedback after a few episodes and said, your sound quality is unbearable, then I started to refine it a little bit. Yeah.
And that's such a great experience to have, to like realize that you need to up your game. That means that you have a game that's worth upping, you know, and that's a really great, like it's amazing how powerful it is just starting, just flipping on that microphone, just start talking. And you'll know, like, this is why ignorance is a huge asset for a lot of things, right? Like if I knew when I started Praxis, for example, everything that we were going to go through and all the stuff that I didn't know, I don't think I would have had the courage to start it. Like, I didn't know what I didn't know. And that actually helped me,
right?
You know? And I think that like with publishing a book. So I had mentioned it, I'd have these lofty, oh, maybe I'll publish a book someday, whatever. But I never made it a concrete goal. And now I just published this Crash Your Career, and it's a little pocket book. And most of my books are short. Many of them are collaborations, but this will be the like 9th book that I've published. And none of those were a result of me saying, I'm going to publish a book. They were all a result of me just blogging every day. And then after like a year, I'd be like, hey, there's a cluster of articles about this topic that are really interesting. What if I packaged those up and edited them into a book and published it? And all of a sudden you get, and now that I've gone through the book publishing process a couple of times, not never with a publisher, they're all self-published, but it's such a giant pain. Mm-hmm. If I like knew that ahead of time, and if I set out to publish a book specifically, I don't think I ever would have done it. And would have been an easy thing to be like, oh, I'll get around to it later. But just showing up and blogging every day, it like, all of a sudden it turned into something bigger than that, almost of its own inertia.
Love it. So using this like output of content, whether it's a blog, a podcast, a YouTube channel, as a sort of self-accountability in the skills signaling process is really, really essential, and it's built into the Praxis program, right?
Absolutely. And we're providing and with Craft, we're providing a tool to make that beautiful and simple, to tighten up the way that you display that and how you connect it to, you know, specific roles and skills at specific companies. So that takes us to the final step.
Selling.
So you've got this great set of skills, or good enough, right? Doesn't have to be great. Mm-hmm. And you've got a way to signal it. Now, how do you get people's attention? And this is like the beautiful, this is the cherry on top. This is the 5% that gets you the 5% effort that gets you the maximum, you know, return. So tailoring a pitch to each individual company. So even if you do a project that's slightly more generic, say you do the SEO project I mentioned, and you're just demonstrate your SEO skills, that's great. And if you go and blast out a bunch of applications to a bunch of companies and say, hey, I want to work at your company, I do SEO, here's this project I made for an example, that's better than most. But if you make a specific tailored pitch to one person at one company, where you send them a little 2-minute video, let's say, you say, hey, Joe, I absolutely love your company. You guys are amazing. I've been following you for a while. I went and checked out your FAQ page. I noticed blah, blah, blah. I think you could improve the SEO on that page. I'd love to have you help. Here's a project I did demonstrating my SEO skills. Let me know if you're up for a conversation. Thanks again. Mm-hmm. Now, if you do that, that is incredibly hard to say no to. And I think the relevant analogy here in terms of getting people to start thinking about tailored pitches to specific companies instead of a generic, dear sir or madam, here are my skills, you know, dear company name, you know, where you blast it out to 100 companies. Getting people to think that way, the dating analogy is really helpful. If you are looking to find a new, you know, partner, a soulmate, whatever, maybe you're just looking to go on a couple dates with somebody. If you like go to every bar and just, you know, say, start putting out a bullet point list of 10 reasons that you are highly dateable,
yeah,
and just blast it out everywhere, like what are the odds going to be that you're going to get a good return versus you're somewhere and you notice someone that you find attractive and they seem interesting to you. And you walk up and you start talking to them a little bit. And then you say, hey, you are so fascinating to me. Like, I'm interested in you. I want to know more. These are the things I value and I like about you. Would you be willing to go on a date with me? The odds are so much better. If you do that 5 times, you'll get a better return than blasting out 1,000, you know, here are reasons I'm dateable. And it's for 2 reasons. It's that it's specific to the individual, but it's also that it focuses on the individual. It doesn't focus on you. This is where people go wrong. They view companies as these cold, calculating computer machines that just like process resumes and look for who has the most points, you know,
right,
and then award the interview to those people. And they're not, they're human beings. And if you always talk about you, it comes off very badly. No, if you talk about them, the company, and you show that you care, you show that you know something about them, it's impossible for them to not at least want to give you a chance in an interview. I mean, I get people that have applied for me so many times, and what they send me, it could easily be sent to any company. It's like, hey, I have great leadership skills, great communication skills. I do this, 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 and this. Here's reasons why you should want to work with me. I would love to be hired for your role title.
Right.
Now, you could do that anywhere and just swap out the role title. Contrast that to someone who says, hey, Isaac, I heard about what you're doing with Crash. I followed Praxis for a while, thought it was awesome. I went and looked up what I could find about Crash. Super, super interesting to me. I love the idea of taking this mentality and turning it into a series of tools that you can use with software. In fact, it reminded me of this other thing. Here's a blog post I wrote about it. And your podcast episode with Brett Vinat was absolutely top notch. I love the part you said about doing a company pitch. In fact, that's why I'm doing this right now. Keep up the great work regardless, but I've attached a project for you, right? Talking about me, like I'm a person.
Yeah.
I have ego. Talking about my company and saying, I love your company. I actually know something about your company. You know, better yet, I know something about you, if that's possible. It's not always possible, but depending on who the hiring manager is. That kind of pitch, like make it about them, that is really, really powerful. And it's so rare, it will absolutely stand out.
That personalized process, right? Or that connected process, an authentic process, right? Like you can find 5 companies that you would love to work for. And you can, you don't have to perform excitement and enthusiasm and motivation. You can have it, right? At that point, once you've gone through all of this other like skill building work, when a young person gets to this point, there's going to be a handful of companies that they're really excited about. It reminds me of this story. A friend of mine was getting his PhD in economics back when he was in his early 20s. And he said there was this guy who was also using the lessons of economics to, I forget what you would call it. It's not exactly the law of averages. But when he would go out, right, you talked about dating. This dude, not my friend, but his friend, would literally go and proposition every single woman in a bar. Right. And he says sooner or later, right? Sooner or later. And chances are, yeah, I mean, he's right. But is that going to get you what you want? Right. So if people go out and they say, I want job. Yeah. Sooner or later.
Blast out 1,000 resumes over and over and over. You might get job, but the opportunity you can get, and you're going to get a higher return for a lower input. Actually, people think, well, this takes so much work. Like nobody does this. Even when I tell people to do this and tell them it will work and tell them it will increase their odds of getting an interview, it's like, that's extra work. I'll send out my resume. But it's not extra work because how many months? I mean, I know people that have been on the job market for 6 months and they blasted out hundreds and hundreds of resumes and gotten no responses. If you just took one of those 6 months and went and did a deep dive into 3-5 companies and did a pitch. And especially if you did it like in a way where you made it public, where you had like your personal blog and you're like, hey, here's a project I built for this company. The odds that you're going to get something out of that are so high. I mean, I've seen people, designers who love Apple and say, hey, I did this redesign for Apple Music. Check it out. And they publish it publicly. Now, Apple may not hire them, but a ton of other people are going to be like, whoa, you do good work. Yeah. I want you to do that for me. Right. And so a great way to start thinking about companies that you could do this for, start with products that you use. Start with companies that you like. Mm-hmm. And think about not just the end, the company that produces sort of the end consumer good, but maybe even some companies further back in the process. So say you're a consumer of the School Sucks podcast and you like it. And then you say, well, you know what? I sometimes listen to the School Sucks podcast on SoundCloud. And maybe that's not on SoundCloud, but just an example. And then you go look up, let's see what SoundCloud's all about. Go look at their Wikipedia page. Go see if you can find them on Crunchbase or whatever. Learn a little bit about their company. Where are they based? What kind of work do they do, right? Like companies that you use, whose products you love, dig a little bit, ask a few questions. What do they do? What kind of stuff is interesting to them? Oh, I noticed that Brett uses Zoom for his meetings. What's Zoom? This company out there is making these video conferences that podcasters use now. That's pretty cool. Yeah. That's interesting. I've used Zoom. I like it as a product. And if you can come to it that way, my colleague Chuck Grimmett is really amazing at this. Which is why I'm always hoping companies don't hire him away. Every time we use a tool and like it, he'll like make a video about it. So we use a little online chat tool for Praxis a couple of years ago called, I think it was Chatra. And he wanted it to connect to something, to connect to our Salesforce account or to Slack or something like that. And so he couldn't figure out how to do it immediately. So he like went and learned. He spent a little bit of time and then he like did some little coding and hacked it together. And instead of just doing it, then he made a little video about it and just shared it to the world. Hey, I love this, you know, this tool Chatra, and I wanted it to talk to this other tool, Slack. So I went and did this, and the other thing and made it work. Here you go. The company was like, and he tweeted about it and tweeted at them. And here's a guy who's like openly saying he loves their product, giving them free pub and showing them how to do something with it. And they like tweeted it. They posted it to their blog for their other customers to see. And now everybody that works there and everybody else who sees it is going to see this Chuck Grimmett guy who does this, who goes out of the way to demonstrate skills in this way. Like that's highly marketable. That guy could get an interview in a minute with any of these companies just by doing something that small.
I love it. Now, do you have people who are beta testing Crash or is Crash up and running? People are using it at this point.
So yeah, we have beta testers right now. It should be, fingers crossed, that the basic version of a Crash profile, which you can take out there like your personal Iron Man suit on the job market, should be available for free to the general public in early May. So we're real close. We've got beta testers right now. We're dialing in a lot of things. We're using it. A lot of them are using it on the job market. We already had somebody get a job at Amazon. We've had a few interviews already. And it's basically like a much more robust way to showcase your skills. And we're adding a lot of tools like the ability to do some of these tailored pitches and a whole bunch more stuff we're going to be rolling out over the next, several months. So
awesome. I ask because, in this conversation that we've had about the selling of these skills over the last 15 minutes or so, it's a 10-point bulleted list in the book, right? Every single one of those bullets could be its own show, right? I would love to talk to somebody who's gone through the process of picking the 5 to 10 companies and how much deliberation went into that, right? That's 45 minutes to an hour, that conversation right there. So yeah. I would love to, at some point in the future, connect with people who are doing this and go through these things one by one. That'd be awesome.
We will make it happen. I'll get from some of our early beta users or just early users when we launch publicly. And what it'd be an awesome thing to do because it's a pretty amazing process, and we're continuing to build out more content and guidance as well as tools to do some of those things. So initially it's the skills profile, as I mentioned, but things like a job hunting dashboard where you can use, have a tool there to help you. Okay, you've identified the companies, put them in here. Now here's where you're going to do the research, and kind of a guided way to both track it and kind of guide you along the process of this job hunt experience. And again, it's all about putting you in the driver's seat. It's all about you. You are the one out there on the hunt. You are taking action. You are the one saying, I'm going to come prove to you that I can create value. You're the initiator rather than passively shooting out applications and hoping for a callback.
Right. Aggressive. I love
it. Yes.
So if people want to learn more, once you get to the site, you can just fill out a form and sign up, right?
Yeah, that's right. Crash.co is where you want to go. There's a link to the book there, which is also on Amazon, Crash Your Career. We call it a pocketbook, really slim. Great graduation gift, by the way, if you want to buy a stack of them for people for graduation gifts.
Yes.
You can find the Crash Your Career book at crash.co. You can sign up if you're listening to this right when it comes out. Sign up for early access and you'll be added to the list and you'll be notified right away. You'll be first to be notified when the platform's available. If you're listening to this a few weeks after it comes out, hopefully it will be live then. So crash.co is where you can find everything.
Awesome. We should do this more often.
We should, man. I mean, you came down in Charleston. I feel like we should have just had a microphone right then and there, but I know you like to do the high quality stuff.
I would have loved that, but it is also nice to have the unrecorded conversations because have you been in those situations? I mean, you do a podcast where it's like the microphone is not on and the greatest things in the world are happening and everyone's so loose and comfortable. And then it's like, okay, red record button and things change. Now, obviously you and I, we did not have that experience today.
We had no, unless you're members of the Ultra Super Plus Premium Secret Brett Vinat Support Club, then you can access those conversations. But for everyone else, we didn't have any special conversations ahead of time.
When you get a chance to just hang out with people in real life and not record it, even though I walk away from so many of those situations and I go, oh, I should have recorded that. And I felt that way after we had lunch that day. That was just such an awesome, we did so many topics. I barely even had time to eat my food. I was the only one who didn't, but I was just talking the whole time about so many different things. It was really energizing. It was really a highlight of my trip down south. So thanks for that too.
Well, we got to find a way to do some kind of a live session. So TK Coleman and I do this Office Hours podcast, which is a blast. And we should find a way to do like a School Sucks Office Hours live mashup episode or something. That'd be a lot
like
of fun.
Like live and interactive with other people?
Yeah, like live, like with
people. Oh, I love it.
I think that'd be pretty cool. Then we could just do like questions from the audience, just riff on whatever topics. Yeah.
Let's do it. Yeah, let's figure that out. Right. Well, for now, thank you so much for having this conversation. Thanks for the extra time. Thanks for your enthusiasm and your energy and your positivity. I really appreciate it. It was great to talk to you.
Yeah, likewise, Brett. Keep up the good work. Take one.